Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, welcome to another episode of This Life. Bob, welcome. How you doing, buddy?
Good afternoon. Good evening.
It's a weird, emotional sort of time to be meeting.
I didn't cry, but I watched Scott videos all night on YouTube and laying
in bed.
You put
some up on Facebook last night, I noticed. Yeah.
So sad. So, I saw him like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, I have a code with all my clients, everybody that knows me, thousands of people. When I look in your eyes, if I bump into you, and I look in your eyes and I say, "You all right?"
That means
to say,
"You're not all right." That means I know you're not all right.
And he said, "No, I'm cool. Why?" Yeah. And that's the answer to the death march. So many people have told me weeks or months before, "No, I'm cool. Why?" That's always the answer. Why?
Because there was somebody else. Yeah. There's somebody else, because they want to know why am I not covering this good enough. Right, you know how addicts think, right? Right.
What are you picking up on?
Yeah, I need to cover this better.
And if Scott's thing is he had an eating disorder too.
I
so
know.
Thin.
Well, hold on now. Can we really talk about this? Because you and I have been involved with him for a long time. Not recently. I've not been involved with him, but
I just care about his kids. I mean, his wife and I have pretty been through the wars for 20 years
with him.
Sad is Michael, his brother, died a few years ago.
That's when I really started worrying about Scott.
Yeah, and then there's so many things to talk about when you talk about Scott Weiland, the advent of Suboxone, the advent of specialized treatment for celebrities, the
sober coaches,
sober
and companions.
Coaches. He is the textbook of all that's gone wrong in American medical addiction treatment.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's another, it's like a three-headed beast of the celebrities who created the new Malibu kind of stuff, right?
Paradigm, yeah.
One is Robert
Downey.
Sober.
Yep. Well, right. He got out of it a weird way.
Yeah, he got out of it, but he obviously turned his life around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he went through all that kind of specialized treatment.
Yeah, and then he just went
ended up
to
a cry help, I think.
Yeah, well, he's but, piece of it, yeah.
Yeah, but the other component, the other person is still not sober. I dealt with him like 6 months ago.
I'm
not going to name that person. But
one we've treated, one we're scared about?
No, I've dealt with personally.
Yeah.
So it was that advent of the mid-90s nouveau sobriety Bob Timmons world that now
Let's
we're
just
20
call,
years...
I'm not going to blame that on Bob Timmons. Let's just say Malibu. Malibu cure. You know what I mean?
Well, I was on tour with Scott. I can talk about it like... I was on tour with Scott, and he had a sober companion.
When he had that, I knew we were in trouble.
Yeah, well, let me tell you how it went.
I know there ain't no sober companion that can withstand a Scott Weiland.
Well, yeah, the
probably
guy
he ended up using with him, right?
That's when it's the first sober companion I ever saw. And once he started using again, I was looking at the guy like, and he looked at me and said, "What the fuck am I supposed to do?"
Exactly. I remember those kinds of companions.
Like the whole sober companion thing is so ridiculous. Like, what is a person doing?
Yeah.
It didn't work with John Belushi, who I think was the original.
Is that right? He had a sober companion?
Yeah, he had big guys that famous manager hired to keep him away from drugs.
Wow.
What was the... Yeah.
I don't know if that's really interesting.
It's
I didn't
in
know
the
that.
Wired book.
Wow, crazy.
And I saw him with those big guys.
Huh.
And I think big guys beating up drug dealers and pulling drugs out of your hand is better than sober companions.
I sort of agree. Although there are now good sober companions, but you don't know who they are. You know what I mean? They're hard to find.
Well, I only was going to do it one time. I was so against it. And, you know, that's ridiculous. What are you supposed to do? Keep people from themselves and stuff. But then... You know, I'm a human being. So Buddy Arnold calls me and goes, "There's a sober companion gig I think you might want." And I was like, "I don't do that kind of shit." And he's like, "Why don't you hear who it is first?" And I was like, well, who is it? And he goes, Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Oh.
And I love Lynyrd Skynyrd. Buddy knew it. Buddy knew all kinds of music, right? Yeah. He knew that that's one of my three favorite bands of all times.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'll talk to them.
Did you
so
do
I
it?
Go. No, wait,
would you have been on a plane?
Listen how crazy it is. I go to meet him at Buddy's office, right? The
yeah.
manager of Lynyrd Skynyrd and the guy who's now so sadly passed away.
Sober.
And I walk in.
Sober, right?
No.
This is before that.
This is what?
We had another guy that was died sober, or like lung cancer or something.
Yeah.
That guy.
There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
This was a guy that didn't make it. So I walk in, Buddy's office. You've been there. Mm-hmm. It's the manager of Lynyrd Skynyrd, the guy, and then I walk in, and the manager goes, oh, no, this ain't going to work at all. The hell is this? And I was like, excuse me? And he goes, no, we need a big guy.
Did you take the job? You didn't do it.
No, they didn't want me because I'm too small.
Would you have been on the airplane that went down?
No, this is after that.
Okay. Right.
This guy survived the airplane crash didn't survive addiction.
Right, that guy, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Scott, it's just so sad.
The only thing I remember about Scott, aside from some of the most difficult work ever, he was tough.
Yeah. He's the reason that we actually have the day that I came to Los Encinas, when you said, oh my God, because we had been talking about it for months, was I was going there to visit him.
Oh, really?
And
I didn't know that.
Somehow your evening outpatient counselor had disappeared or something.
Yeah, another mess.
So.
I will tell you that when he was sober, which he was for a period of time.
Yeah, he was for a lot in the 90s.
That's when I knew
him. When people thought he wasn't sober,
yeah,
he was.
That's when I knew him. And he could not be a sweeter guy.
No, he's so gentle and sweet. He was like a little brother to me, like a little brother that you don't want to hang around. But but I spent a year and a month touring with them. The Bicycle Thief opened for Stone Temple Pilots. And it was an interesting ride.
I bet.
Because, you know, he so wanted love and approval. That's an addict.
Right, but that's a human too, right?
Yeah.
And addicts are just extra tender that way.
Yeah.
And then they have the trauma and all that stuff getting in the way of it. Right.
But think about this. Think about a dad who he had two sons, both of them are dead of drugs.
Oh. Is he an alcoholic or anything? Does his genes?
No, he's like a normal guy, kind of guarded.
So sad.
But just, oh, God.
Well, I just step back and go, well, if he'd had cancer or anything else, as a physician, I would look at it like, okay, well, he did pretty well with it, you know, 20 years and... I mean, it's weirdly objective. I really, not even philosophical, just like clinical. Just like, all right, 20 years, not bad. You know, I didn't give him four back in 1995.
Yeah.
And by the way, this disease only takes the greatest, right?
But that's the thing that there's been a lot of talk on the internet about who's a great singer and what do you think of this and all. It's weird. The internet is its own weird community board.
Horrible.
So now it's like looking at grunge, who are the greatest singers? Though the day before when he died, people, you know, didn't respect him.
Oh.
He dies and he's the greatest grunge singer
of
all time.
People forget what Michael Jackson was like the day before he died. It was Wacko Jacko the day before he died.
I know.
And
so
then all of a sudden.
But
still people don't understand that was addiction. They don't understand it.
But what's fascinating about STP is those songs stand up. I don't even think Nirvana songs stand up the way STP songs do. They had a meaning, Nirvana, but when you just listen to that time with the wooden hand, the melodies of those STP songs are pretty powerful.
Who wrote them? Scott
Redden? Robert, the bass player, and Scott.
Have you talked to, I'm blanking everybody's names, the guitarist?
Dean. Well, Khalil's really close friends who's going to call in today with Dean, and we'll check in on them And Khalil, his first job sober 15 years ago before he became a health food guru, was Sober Companion.
Oh, let's talk to him about that.
Yes.
That'll be interesting.
Very much so.
All right, before you go out to Khalil, maybe we want to talk about this after Khalil, but we had a mass shooting here.
I know.
And it ain't going to be the last time this kind of bullshit happens.
Well, I think you can wave your independent flag. If you think the government is keeping you safe from terrorism for these billions and trillions of dollars and all this irritation at airports. You're crazy. That woman proclaimed her dedication to ISIS on Facebook in San Bernardino, California.
Yeah.
And nobody even watched her.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
There was probably 1,000 or 2,000 Facebook people who were thinking, I hope somebody's going over to her house.
Well, not only that, I am very angry with the current, particularly the attorney general, who on the day of the shooting said, my greatest concern is that people backlash against Muslims. Not your safety, not crushing ISIS. The greatest concern I have
is that people's feelings get hurt.
Is people's get a backlash feelings and get feelings get hurt. That's my concern. And then the director of the FBI gets on and goes, well, this wasn't a cell. That's scarier to me. That's not reassuring. The fact that it's a cell, you can dig the roots out. These are, you can't do anything about this, particularly if you guys aren't watching properly. So stop it with their, it
they
wasn't a
but
cell.
But you know how the government always says they're using deep underground, nowhere, you can't find
the
them on
web,
the internet.
The dark web.
Yeah. They were on Facebook.
Yeah, I know. I know.
How deep is that? I don't know. I don't know a lot about the internet. I'm kind of technically retarded, but I know how to get on
Facebook.
Don't
use that word, PC. I'm the PC principal here.
Well, so the strange thing, how about this?
Yeah.
How about the competency of government? San Bernardino, they got there within 4 minutes, police, right?
Yeah.
But the culprits got away.
Right.
So they put all public buildings in San Bernardino County on lockdown.
Right.
Kids in Joshua Tree, California,
yeah,
100 miles away, had to stay at school until 5 o'clock. And then their parents of 5 and 7 and 9-year-old children had to be explained to why mommy couldn't come and get them. Mm. That's your government.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a very effective response. But I think they thought, though, to be fair,
that they're going somewhere and going to do more.
Well, they thought disgruntled employee. I mean, it kind of looked like that. I was actually broadcasting on KBC when this happened, so I was reporting it.
Yeah.
And we were trying to make sense of it, as I try always to do. And my first impulse was, first, I had the shameful response of, well, here we go again. People with mental illness that aren't being properly, you know, managed and getting their hands on guns and no one can speak up about it, and they have the right to guns, and we got to do something about this. That was my first response.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. Second response was, because remember, it was in a facility that dealt with people with mental illness and neurodevelopmental disorders and stuff. I thought another Sandy Hook. Wrong. Then we thought, oh, it's a group of employees, a gathering, somebody gets angry. Oh, this is a disgruntled employee. This is a post office. Somebody went postal.
That's you know the first thing
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah, but then... You start hearing body armor,
black
combat
mask.
Gear.
No, I heard
two,
black
right,
mask.
Two or three people. It's like, whoa, that's not postal.
Wait a minute. What is ISIS's flag? Black mask.
Yeah.
Black. When I heard black, I was like, that's ISIS. So right. Whatever.
And that's what it was. And then in the first press conference, the assistant director of the FBI locally here said, we have reason to believe this terrorist links. And then nobody would report that. Nobody would report it. That made me furious. Because the FBI is not saying that unless there's very good evidence that that's the case. And it's still, you read the papers, and the headline is no cell. No cell involved. Not, this is a new form of terrorism. We need to figure out how to deal with this.
Yeah, it's crazy, but, you know.
How's the airport? We have people sitting here who have been flying recently. The airport's tough?
There's tough? Cops yeah. all over Hollywood. I was driving yeah. around last night. Police everywhere.
I know. Listen,
night.
I had to go to radio the night of. And there were people with the rollers going all over the place, going at high speeds.
Well, I was nervous because I think I have a warrant out for my arrest for texting.
What? Are you fucking kidding me, you asshole?
No, because
I'm not going to come bail you out. I got to let the consequences come to bear.
No, I got the money. I got the money. So my mailing address, because it's cheaper car insurance, is the Joshua Tree House. And I thought
you,
I paid this ticket.
You fucking cannot resist being antisocial. You have to take an antisocial stand and have
well,
consequences.
Well, I thought it was unfair.
Or you're not happy. Yes, I'm sure there was a whole feeling attached to it.
I really wasn't texting.
So I'm gonna make my antisocial stand and get arrested.
$862.
You. That was the original the ticket?
No,
that's
like,
what it is
it's
now.
It's like 180. Now
yeah,
it's a warrant.
How's that feel?
Now it's a warrant.
Dude. I'm so disappointed, but I'm not surprised.
But I thought I paid it because I had another one. I get them quite often. But you text when you drive.
I really don't like doing that. I try not to.
That was avoidant answer.
No, it's not, because I'm angry at people that, like, they, you know how I'm OCD, so I have to respond to everybody when get to me. And I get these texts. I'm like, you know, everyone who texts me knows I'm driving, knows I'm on the freeway, because my schedule every day is, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, so I'm just like, I'll just give one word or two word answers. So, but still, I'm pissed.
So tell the policeman when he pulls you over.
No,
I will have. You only sent one word.
No. If the cop pulls me over and says, "What's your excuse?" I will say, "I have none. I have no excuse.
This is not okay.
This is not good with me. I'm pissed. I did.
Okay, here comes my antisocial. I don't agree with the law."
Oh, geez, you're such an asshole. So you can't. Where does that come from in you?
I think my dad had a little bit of it.
Is it? You think it's like in your makeup, genetic makeup, or do you think it's from all the bullshit you deal with as a kid?
I think all of my dad's side of the family kind of antisocial. I mean,
is a genetic piece to it.
Isn't Goldwater Republicanism kind of antisocial?
That's why I'm asking you.
See, because that's, people don't know the difference between what a real Republican is, what I grew up as, and this new weird Republican.
I know. Well, how about the Abraham Lincoln Republican versus what we're looking at now?
But I grew up in a family that always questioned the government. And it's switched now to Democrats always question the government.
Yeah. Well, no, the Republicans.
Everybody always questions the government.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much stay out of my business.
That's what Goldwater Republicanism was.
It still is. Well, that's more like libertarian now. Stay out of my business, shrink down, but protect me. And where were you? And why weren't you there when I needed you? It's that kind of thing. It's a weird double-edged sword.
So there was a lot of anti-social.
But what is the feeling with it? Why do you have to do that? It's so inconvenient.
Being the warrant thing?
Yeah, letting that feeling command your behavior to the point where you have these ridiculous consequences. And I think it feels good to you to have these crazy consequences.
Now you want to get even weirder.
Yes, I do.
So a lot of times when I get pulled over, they say, "Dr. Drew." Oh. So I know you never get tickets. That's a Los Angeles thing. Only right, Los Angeles
okay, so
know that.
So let's flip
so I'm hoping
if I get
pulled over and I have an $800 texting warrant, they'll go, "Oh, Dr. Drew, let me slide.
Bob, when they say that, what do you feel?
I tricked.
What do you feel?
I feel
what's
like
the feeling?
The
I understand you.
It's a
that's
junkie
a thought.
Move.
What's the feeling though?
Good.
When I get that, I feel horrible. Horrible. I don't feel guilt very often.
Have they let you go because you're Dr. Drew from a ticket?
Yes, and I hate it. And I hate it. And I don't like it. And by the way, behave much better because of that for a much longer period of time than if they ticketed me. Because I'm so guilty. I'm like, oh,
bad.
Shit, I shouldn't get
Why
this
do you
break.
Feel guilty? So we are
feel guilty because
heard.
I was speeding. and I have no excuse.
Let me tell a great story about Flea. We're going up PCH. She just got this Porsche. She's going 160. Oh. We get pulled over right by that Ventura, like that, where you're getting into Ventura, right on PCH at
the
top.
The hill.
Yeah. And he gets pulled over and he's like, shit. I think my license is suspended.
Oh, shit.
And I'm like, oh, my God. The guy walks up and goes, "Is that who I think it is?" And he goes, "If you think it's Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, it is." And the guy let us go.
That's ridiculous. I get mad at that because I feel like the law should be applied evenly to everybody. You know what I mean? I should not get replaced because of that. I don't like that. I don't dig it. And
everybody evenly but me.
Well, that's why I'm curious about this. This is the distinction, you know, OCD, me, versus antisocial, you. You feel great and good and you've gamed it. I feel shitty and horrible and guilty and like, you know, it's like awful. You know, when I drive away from one of those, it's happened to me probably in my life a half dozen times that somebody let me go for one reason or another.
Yeah.
God, I feel terrible. I just feel so bad.
Let's talk about getting away. One time I had Sinead O'Connor's Jeep for some reason. Don't ask. She's in real trouble too.
Right now?
We should check in. Like, it's crazy what's going on with her. She wrote an open letter to her son disowning him. He's 11.
Well,
she was gonna kill herself.
Yeah,
now
she seems psychotic.
Yeah, she's having trouble. So I had her Jeep.
Is this psych or is this...
Yeah, it's psych.
Oh, poor thing.
I had her Jeep. And I was copying drugs downtown. And
this is when?
This is in the late 80s. Yeah. And so I'm...
You had her Jeep?
I had her Jeep. It's a long story. She lived here, and I had the same manager, and then she left, and I ended
up... No good story.
I found the keys in a drawer.
All right.
You know, so you stole I'm driving
Jeep.
It.
You stole her Jeep. I got it. This Mr. Antisocial.
Anyways, I was just borrowing it, and no one was...
Yeah.
So I'm down there, and I've already been to rehab a couple times, so it's like 2 or 3 in the morning, I get pulled over. I got balloons in my mouth. The guy goes, registration, and I go, and I had an AA big book on the front seat, and he goes, what are you doing down here? I had a driver's license, had the registration. I said, this is my girlfriend's car. I don't know where the insurance is.
Did people know who Sinead O'Connor was then?
Oh, God, yeah. when she was nothing big. Compares to you. Was,
yeah, yeah.
So he says, well, is this the Sinead O'Connor? And I was like, oh, yeah. And he goes, what are you doing down here? And I go, well, sir, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a sponsee of mine is on the loose down here. I came down here. I know it's wrong. I know it's a dangerous neighborhood.
How are you keeping the balloon from sort of...
You just push it in the side, down, back. You only swallow if you get arrested.
Okay. So you're prepared to swallow. You're prepared to... But you don't want to lose it, right?
You don't want to lose it if you're going to get away.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so why... This
it's
is why...
It's such a cumbersome way to live, Bob.
I know. I don't live like that anymore. I just live in the kind of...
A little bit like
75%
that.
75% right way. So...
Could you make it 95? I'd be much happier. I really would.
There's God. So many laws, Drew.
I know that does make me angry, because when you are wanting to be a law-abiding citizen, you can't even keep track of it. You know,
here's an interesting the bureaucracy, and that drives everyone nuts, right? So there's this big flood at my house and hills, and so the trash cans get all washed down all the way down to Beechwood, and everybody's trying to figure out which trash cans are theirs.
This was when?
This is like about 6 months ago.
Where do you live up there?
I live off Graciosa.
Whose house is that?
It's mine, my sober living. I moved into
it. Oh, okay, got it.
Right. So we're all trying to sort out which trash cans, and they're not markers. They don't have names on most of them.
Yeah.
And so I ended up losing my green one. Mm. Try to get the government to give you back your green trash can without having to pay for it.
Oh, no, impossible.
I said, listen, I already am paying for it. It's just not here.
Bob, and Corolla goes over this over and over again, which is the government, the only things government is good at is when you owe them money. Then they're very good.
Oh, yeah.
But if they owe you money, you'll never get it.
Impossible. I'm efficient about that.
But listen, you seem never to get out of Beechwood Canyon.
I've been back there. I live 4 doors away from where I lived when I was 20 years old.
Okay. And is that the house you burned down?
No. Which one is that?
You want to tell the story?
Of which?
You and John or Flea or something.
Oh, that was in Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I thought we were collecting Tom Sizemore. You showed me. You said that's the house I burned down.
Yeah, that was behind the Comedy Store.
Oh, we were up there. I thought we were in Beechwood. Okay.
No, Beechwood's where we all live. You know what it was, and we talk about it. When we were kids, we would go to Hollywood Boulevard, right?
Yeah.
17, 18, 19.
Yeah.
And you'd look at the Hollywood sign, and you thought, if I ever make it, I'm going to live up there.
Yeah.
Well, up there is Beechwood Canyon.
Yeah.
It is kind of ghetto, though.
Like, no, it's been all redeveloped, though.
Well, not my house.
It's very nice. I would love to live up there. It's nice.
You know whose house I lease is Rolanda Watts.
No way.
Yeah, she's my landlord.
What the? How weird is that?
It's the smallest world in the world.
Rolanda, you can see on my HLM program regularly. I love her.
I know.
Her.
She's the greatest.
And you lease it for your sober living?
Yeah. Well, I had it as a sober living, and then when I got a divorce, I had to move somewhere, and I moved into half of it. And,
oh, my God.
And so I
God.
Live in half, and the kids live in half.
Oh, what a great deal for her.
Yeah.
Oh,
but I mean, it's an 80s house. It's not like it's a modern, you know, like what you the fixed up houses.
Right. So tell us the story about you burning the house down.
So, well, it wasn't me that burned it down. It was John.
Oh, here you go. You're doing the social stuff.
So
wasn't me.
But when I was driving up the street and saw all the fire trucks, I knew what house it was at. So John
Frusciante.
He's a little.
Pepper.
I had left him alone for 2 days, which isn't good. You know what I mean?
But you were using two at the time, right?
Yeah, but I was in charge of making sure he didn't burn the house down, and I went to a
they
girl's
gave
house.
You, they did not give you that responsibility.
Well, it was kind of.
They just abandoned both you two, and then you took that responsibility.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
But then Martine took it after me.
No, because people were fleeing both you guys.
Oh, yeah, nobody wanted. The healthy people didn't, but amongst us unhealthy, Gibby. you know, Perry were just like, you're going to keep an eye on John, right? And I was like, okay, I will.
That is the drug addict union going, you're out. We're moving on.
Well, they would come by for sure, but they
Why?
To do drugs.
That's right. So there you go.
Nobody wanted to be there permanently, and I had no place to go.
Where is Kibbe now? Texas or something?
No, he lives in New York.
Perry's out here, right?
Perry's here, yeah. Okay. So that was an interesting intervention. A bunch of people who are all drug addicts themselves doing an intervention on John one night.
Using?
Me, Kibbe, Perry, Peter DeStefano, the guitar player from Pornos.
Pornos for Pirates.
Yeah. We did an intervention on John while we were smoking crack with him. So that should tell you something. I don't know. But yeah, the house had to be burned down because it was too filled with ghosts.
That was what John thought?
Yeah.
So we actually lit it intentionally on fire.
Yeah, to get the ghosts out. And then I came walking up, and he goes, oh, my God, you're alive. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I thought you were in there. So he set the house on fire.
Still thinking you were in there.
Thinking that I might be in there. But the ghosts had to be chased away.
Do you wonder now, Bob, why I told everybody we can't be around you anymore? do you have any feelings about that?
We were standing there and the arson people were talking and whatever. And we stood there for about an hour. And then it was obvious that we could go. And I said, where do you want to go? And he goes, let's go to the chateau. And we just went to the chateau. Oh, the party continued. See, and that's not what kids are doing now.
They're not having fun like you guys.
It's not interesting. It's not interesting. Yeah. It's not worth it. It's so pedestrian.
Well,
the
no,
use
it's,
of young people.
It's listless.
I have two 20-year-old kids
rudderless.
Living in my house.
Rudderless.
They've been to a million rehabs already. They're 20.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on?
I like what you always say when you try to ask them to, you know, inspire what it is they want to do and live for so they can get sober. And what do they say?
They don't know.
They say, I don't know. What do you want me to do?
Yeah,
which
they
is
don't
the weirdest
know.
Thing of all.
And, you know, no passion about things. And I think it's that, you know, there's a lot of different arguments as to how we got this generation of kids. But kids have been rite of passage taking drugs for three generations.
Yeah.
Why is it that this one is non-functional and in rehab for life? I'm talking about rehab for life.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite moments of Lost in Cenas was, so we're all worried about alcohol withdrawal seizures and benzo withdrawal seizures, mm-hmm. which I never saw one, but so this woman had a seizure on the patio there off mm-hmm. of Sasha's office, mm-hmm. and Barry was walking by.
Barry, my partner.
Yeah, and I was down on the ground with her, and he just stood over, and he said, doing all right, doing good. Okay.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
And then she sat up, and he just walked through his car.
For an alcohol withdrawal, that's all you got to do. People get all excited about it, but for... No, we had a lot of those, if you
she
remember. They used to happen in the treatment room a lot, too.
Yeah, this is just me and her on the patio.
Yeah. Well, the big risk is that they fall and hit their head. That's what drove us crazy. But alcohol withdrawal seizures don't usually, there aren't, they sort of collapse slowly into them if you noticed.
And you can tell there, I could tell she was
you could tell it's
happening
coming, yeah.
and then I said
that's
it
right.
again.
It's not like a brain tumor seizure where they just boom over and it can break their skull and stuff.
Yeah,
it's a little bit, it can be that way, but fortunately it's not typical. Anyway, we gotta take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Ladies and gentlemen, where am I appearing? Nate the Man,
Origami
Vinyl,
December 12th.
December 12th.
Fantastic.
I'm gonna be there.
Check it out.
You know what's so great about coming to see me trying to promote a record? You can ask me about your children who are on drugs.
You get a little consult at the same time. Yeah, and also free. You can get the record at drdrew.com at thislifepodcast.com. thislifepodcast.com. And the name of the album?
It's called Survival Songs.
Check it
it's
out.
About surviving. So
let's bring Khalil in here. Let's
he knew Scott. He knows Dean.
Bob, want to click on his Skype there? Hey, Khalil, we met way back, right?
Way back, yeah.
He had sores on his face.
That's a lot of my patients.
So do you like that I lead with that, Khalil?
So let me just
thank you for saying that. Yeah, I had scabs all over my face.
And Khalil, and what I would say if I walked in the room and saw that, I would just go, "How much meth are you doing?"
It was coke, crack.
And if he said that, I would go, If he said that to me, I would go, your dealer's screwing you over. He's putting a bunch of meth in there.
Khalil, was there meth in your crack?
You know, I don't know what I was breaking it down with lemon juice and apple cider vinegar, and I was shooting it.
Oh, let's teach the kids how to do it. Oh,
Mama,
great.
I'm so glad you're alive.
Well, thank you. And then, Dr. Drew, I accosted you recently at the Hard Rock Cafe. I ran up to you and I said, "Oh my God, you help me!" And I'm not quite sure. That was about maybe 6 or 8 months ago. You might have been there for one of the UFC fights.
Hard Rock Cafe. Hold on.
Yeah, all you guys are fans of this UFC stuff.
A little bit. Well, because Mike Catherwood, who I do a Love Line with, is so into it. Well, wait, Khalil, wait a minute. I don't go to Hard Rock Cafe almost ever.
For UFC?
Was it that in sports bar on Melrose?
No, you were at the Hard Rock Cafe in Vegas.
Okay. Yes. Vegas. Okay. Well, you should have said who you were. Bob's talked about you forever.
Yeah. You know what you are, Khalil? You're the smoothie guy, the genius of smoothies.
I guess, yeah. I don't know.
And many other people. You've helped other people, too.
Oh,
other
yeah,
people.
A
your
lot
name
of
has
people.
Come up a lot, Khalil. I got to tell you, thank you. This is the first time I know I'm speaking directly to you, per se. But Bob's always spoken very glowingly of you, and I know other people that you have really helped. So thank you.
My absolute pleasure, and thanks to both of you guys for being instrumental in saving my life. And at 109 pounds, at 33 years old, oof, as a convicted felon and a high school dropout, I was not feeling any love from anyone, and I didn't feel like I had any hope or any future. And I just jumped off of a G5, and was in a penthouse over the weekend with a friend. None of this is mine, by the way. I want to clarify that. But still,
it's a massive change.
But let me tell you, Khalil.
I need to spend more time with you.
Khalil, so we haven't talked. We talked a little bit of text. We started the show off talking about Scott and Sober Companions and how he was kind of the poster child of the new modern goofy treatment, right?
Yes. Yeah. And just side note, Dean just left. Dean was just here.
Oh, at the store?
Yeah, he just walked out.
Wow.
How's he doing? Is he sad?
He seems okay. I didn't want to bug him because a bunch of people were talking
did
to
you
him.
Cry?
So, you know,
did you cry?
A lot of people may be angry, Bob.
A lot of people are angry. Yeah. Well, I think they're angry at people like us that weren't able to help them. A lot of that.
They'll be angry at him. Yeah, a lot of things. Because it's so
emotional.
I'm frustrated and angry, too, because I just hated what happened to him.
Well, so Khalil, let's go through it. You were a sober companion, not for him, but for a lot of people. And you came to me and you said, "I don't like this. I don't think this is right." Right?
Yeah, it felt pretty icky.
Yeah, it's like, what can you do?
That's a good time. That's a clinical term.
Think about this. You know me in a controlled clinical setting. I try not to see addicts alone. I try to have somebody with me. It's too overwhelming. You become part of the disease, at least a codependent like me, pretty quickly. And so you can't fight it on your
own. And plus they're paying you.
Right.
So you're their servant, right? Khalil, what would you say is the main problem with sober companionism?
I think the main problem is that if you're a drug addict, you obviously have a whole handful of people that are enabling you. And I think, you know, being a sober companion in many cases, not all, but in many, and I would say most cases that I experienced, was doing nothing more than enabling the addict or alcoholic, whatever you guys call it. I call it alcoholic, but
same stuff.
I think you're just ultimately enabling them and allowing them to continue getting exactly what they want, to do exactly what they want, to manipulate everybody, to call the shots. And if you
well, that's
do that,
Scott. That's Scott in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course. And let's not forget, you know, the people that were FedExing him and hand delivering him Suboxone and Subutex over the last decade and a half. I mean, I know the guy personally, and I happen to love him because he was instrumental in helping save my life as well. No names mentioned, but you know, if you keep giving a heroin addict Suboxone and Subutex, what kind of a bottom are they ever really going to reach?
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, and it's so, this is the conundrum for physicians, particularly, which is, how much risk can you tolerate? Given that there is a
Drew's not as just let me preamble because this is going to shock Khalil. Khalil, Drew is not as anti-Suboxone as he used to be.
Well, let me tell you why. I would not allow it. I would not run a unit where it was allowed. Let's be clear about that. I would not allow it because two reasons. One, I'm not a fan of it. I don't want to treat that kind of patient. That's for somebody else to do. Number one. Number two, having opiates on a unit makes a unit impossible to run. Because then they all want the drugs. They can't concentrate. They can't do anything. They're all thinking about the guy on the Suboxone.
I only got 8 milligrams.
Yes. How come he got that? So you know how that goes. But here's the conundrum, and it's a philosophical conundrum. Listen, as a physician, your job is to A, do no harm, and B, save, you know, deal with the priority of saving the life. And how much risk can we as physicians legally take if you know there's something you can give them that will may make them chronically ill, which in my opinion, that's what Suboxone does, but saves their lives.
But they won't die.
Yeah. And that's why it's taking hold. Not only that, and the other thing, Khalil, is there's no money to treat addicts. So all the Obamacare treatment is specifically Suboxone. All of it.
And
you can't afford it
anyway. Mediocre outpatient.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's the ultimate Band-Aid as far as triage goes when you're dealing with somebody who's coming in and, you know, coming in hot and coming in, you know, sick and freaking out. And I don't want to be here.
Well, no, but Khalil, I can deal with that. Listen, Bob and
that's called phenobarbital.
Yeah, Bob and I have skills dealing with shit like that. No problem.
But see, Khalil ran a rehab for a while.
Yeah.
And so Suboxone is the only way to sate them as they're landing because you don't have the ability or the medical staff to monitor clonidine and phenobarbital.
That's right. You need a whole big staff to do the way we used to do it. You have to give up a lot of medicine.
I mean, Suboxone and Subutex and you know, the old, we were doing the injectable stuff.
Buprenorphine.
But you know, it's sort of a panacea in one sense, but then in another sense, you know, myself included, but you know, you go in for treatment and you know that they're going to give you meds and you're a junkie, so chances are you've got some issues with honesty. And the doctor says, you know, how much were you using? Also, as a junkie and a drug addict, you probably have some issues with exaggerating. And you also know if you're a junkie and a drug addict, you're probably really smart as well.
Yep.
Because it takes some intelligence to use drugs with any type of success. You got to be pretty crafty and pretty smart. So the doctor says, how much dope were you using, or how much heroin were you using, or whatever? And your first thought is, I better tell him a lot because this guy's about to medicate.
Oh yeah, of course.
So what ends up happening, like in a case like my friend John, who went through one of these fancy treatment centers out here in Malibu, where I was actually working when I had a couple years sober. He told the doctor, John was a nickel and dime user. You know, he was shooting $10 bags, $20 bags. He told the doctor he was doing 4 grams of heroin a day.
So it gave him a lot of doctor,
And the doctor, who's a really awesome doctor, and I love him, but they ended up giving him, this may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but honest to God, I think they were giving him like 40, 50, 60 milligrams of Suboxone, Subutex. This guy will tell you to this day, he's 10 years sober now, he'll tell you, that was the best run he ever had.
Yeah.
He was higher than a kite and almost died in his sleep because he was so medicated. So it's incredibly dangerous, and everyone abuses it. It prolongs the inevitable. And in my case, when I went to PRC, or when Bob and Matt put me in PRC,
Pasadena Recovery Center,
I knew for a fact that if I allowed them to medicate me and make me comfortable, it would be a matter of weeks or months before I was back on the dope. So what I said to Dr. Bloom, and he was totally against it, I said, give me nothing. I've got to do this once
that's
and for all.
Well, this is what I want to ask.
That's a guy who's surrendered.
Yeah. What you described the state, you were two reactions to have. One, you guys both know that calling somebody a junkie and a liar is under assault. How and calling the word addiction is under assault.
Could hurt their feelings.
How dare you? You're making them criminals, and it adds to their bad feelings about. Oh God. Anyway, so that's under assault. Number one. Number two, you gave a great description of the not even the bottom you were at, the bottom you were scraping. How did you, given that you were scraping that bottom, how does somebody in that condition find clarity and move forward?
Khalil?
Well, I was in a state of surrender versus a
Why?
State of compliance.
Why? Where'd that happen? How'd that happen?
Why was I?
What was that moment?
It was a culmination of moments. Of there was a flat line. There was a 11-day stay at the Twin Towers County Jail.
So you overdosed, and you had a cardiac arrest, you had a actual arrest.
Yeah.
You lost your freedom. Keep going.
Yeah.
Well, also, Khalil, I was there, and your thing of being 33, you kept repeating it for every day for weeks. Somehow that number made it seem like, what am I doing when I'm 33? What's happened to my life?
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, fair enough.
And
well, I mean, that comes down to sheer stupidity. If you remember, no, seriously, because if you also remember, I was a musician and I made music, and I assumed or hoped and prayed or tried to kill myself by the time I was 27. And if you wind up 33, still trying to die at 27, you got things a little bit messed up. So
you got numbers backwards.
A little bit.
So let's talk about now. Here's the thing. Years and years sober, you have a book out, right? You have a thriving...
I have a book that just came available on Amazon.
What's it called?
Two days ago called I Forgot to Die.
Okay, I got
to
put that on my website.
It's a good one.
I Forgot to
it's
Die.
It's a good
Somebody's
one.
Somebody's going to help me
with
that.
And it's got his PRC admission picture on the cover of the book.
Oh, my God. Crazy.
It's so awesome. So, and then now, but let's talk about now. He is the guy that people turn to about nutrition, health, and wellness. He's Rick, Ruben, Anthony, everybody out there goes to Khalil and says, what do I do? I need to do this. I have that. I've watched it. He's like a nutritionist doctor inside his health food store in Malibu. And
nice.
It works. It worked for me. Well, turmeric. Tell us about turmeric,
Jude. Turmeric's good stuff. What
does it do?
You know,
it makes you feel younger.
Yeah, turmeric is, in my experience, and I'm definitely not a doctor by any stretch of the imagination, but turmeric for me is sort of, you know, sort of like the Suboxone of the juice world. It really is a panacea. It reduces inflammation. It's a mood elevator. It helps with digestion. It just makes you feel incredible. Anytime you take down your inflammation, your body, your organs, everything is functioning.
Especially when you're old. So,
well, yeah, we got a lot of aches and pains and creaks from what we did to our bodies, and so you take turmeric and ginger and some raw honey and some you know, cayenne and black pepper, and you mix it all together in a drink.
Drew's gonna comment. I'm seeing it on his face. Come on.
No comment. It's all good. It can't hurt you for sure.
I'm telling you, Drew, it makes you feel incredible.
Well, what I was gonna comment on was the aging process. And you don't have to do stuff to yourself to have inflammation and aches and pains. There's a natural aging process.
So isn't it good to
eating real foods is all good. But what is inflammation in an aging body is a complicated phenomenon. It's not just your joints, certainly.
It's my lower back because I broke my back.
Well,
eating healthier. No, we're going to get into it, Khalil. Eating healthier has made me feel
good. You've lost some
better.
Weight and stuff too.
Yeah.
That helps your back.
But wait a minute, Khalil. It's only about losing weight that helps your back.
But here's the deal. Hold on a second. Well, blood flow to your blood. I believe in this stuff about improving the blood supply of the back. And here's the thing, that the real issue of inflammation is in the lining of arteries. It's an organ system called the endothelium. And the endothelium is an extremely complicated physiology. And so, yes.
As you age, what happens to that system?
That there is a complex relationship between cholesterol metabolism, chylomicrons, medial and endothelial lining of arteries, and how the immune system...
So your blood is not circulating as well.
...affects the arteries. So the arteries slowly can break down. They can have cytokines and activation of certain immune factors that can affect, again...
Yeah, I had that, and then I started doing what Khalil told me to, and now I feel better.
Well, the weird thing is, the weird thing is the inflammation. Why don't we just take anti-inflammatories then?
Because it's cooler to go to Khalil's.
You can take medication, but in my
no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's not a good idea. Plus, it'll kill your kidneys and give you ulcers and all kinds of other good stuff. So
yeah, it's a bunch of chemicals. Yeah.
So is turmeric. So turmeric's a bunch of chemical too. That's why it only works if it's a bunch of chemicals, because we're all just a bag of chemicals. That's all we are.
Yeah.
Man-made versus nature.
I would prefer to just eat some root that's grown in the ground that makes me feel better.
I would too. I'm with you. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree. I'm with you.
Whether it's a placebo effect or whether it's a real effect.
There is a placebo effect. And let's not shortchange the fact that you're such a loving environment at Sun Life, and everybody's so energetic and positive and happy and doing positive things, that it has a placebo effect on your mood as you enter in there. And then when you see Anthony Hopkins, it doesn't hurt.
I cannot confirm or deny whether he's
I know,
in my juice
but you
box.
Know what? I've seen 100 celebrities in your store, and that's the only one I was impressed by.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm very, very grateful to be in the position that I'm in. And it saddens me that, you know, that we had to start out by talking about a guy who was so talented and so awesome that just sort of fell through the cracks in terms of recovery, mostly because he had the ability to, with the money and fame that he had the ability to duck and weave and bob and avoid the actual process of getting better.
But here's the thing, but Khalil, it's so random, and that's what I texted you the night it happened. It's so random because we do know people the same as Scott who have gotten sober. And so
why is it
some people, no matter what category, economics, fame, socioeconomic education, yeah. I can give you an example of somebody that died that had that was pretty much like that,
yeah.
And somebody who got sober and thrived.
I know.
It makes no sense.
I know. That's why I always dig into it. How do you turn it around? What's that moment of clarity? Can we ever box that for somebody and hand it to them?
I think it's a chain from
some people just say it's some spiritual something.
Yeah, I think it. But what about that? It's a chain from here's a strange chain. If you really want it, from Timmons to Anthony to me to Khalil, that's the chain that just of that love and that effect of other people and being active and involved.
Well,
in
I totally agree
to each other.
Completely agree that it is about others. That's the recovery process. That some sort of weird connection to somebody gives you the moment of clarity that you can start to help yourself. And I don't know exactly what that is, but I've had many people describe a new pair of glasses.
Yeah.
Something that lets them have some perception. And it's usually something about another person.
I choose to call it love,
well,
my friend.
Now that I don't work in the world of recovery and I don't have to worry
you
about...
You can criticize it like crazy.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't have to. Yeah, I don't have to worry about risking my reputation. I think what it really comes down to is unconditional love.
Yeah, it really is, but you have to listen.
Have a boundary. You have to have a boundary.
The TV show
The
Nick,
love.
The Nick just portrayed something like that. They did. They had a woman.
Do you watch The Nick, Khalil? That TV show, the Steven Soderbergh. Drew's obsessed with it.
But the guy, the lead doctor, the famous doctor, is a heroin cocaine addict. He gets sober because of a relationship with this special woman who had syphilis and her nose is all rotted off and stuff. But she had a certain quality that, frankly, I recognized. It was like, oh, they're doing this right. And the now sober, whatever, addict is trying to help alcoholics. He's just trying to figure it out. He's cutting parts of their brains out. He's doing all this crazy shit.
Yeah.
And he starts thinking about something called the talking cure that they're studying in Germany. And one alcoholic, he becomes that. One alcoholic goes, how do you stay sober? And he goes, well, I have this relationship with this woman. He goes, can I talk to her? And he goes, yeah. And he talks to her, and you know, they portray that phenomena. But listen, guys, we got to wrap this up. Khalil, I so appreciate you being here, and God bless you.
You're the king, Khalil.
Keep thriving, my friend. It's so great to hear you.
The mayor of Point Doom.
I'm gonna text Bob a link, or however you can buy I Forgot to Die on Amazon. I'm going to text it to him, Dr. Drew, and if there's any way you could help spread the word, because it really is a story of hope.
While we were sitting here, I sent an email out to my web people to put it up on my website. So
you're awesome, man. Thank you for helping me.
It's got the greatest cover of any book ever.
I can't wait to see it.
Thank you. And Bob, you're in the book, so I credit you with saving my life, so you better promote me.
I hope it doesn't talk about that transvestite I was with in Cleveland like Anthony's book does.
Oh my God, that's hysterical.
It doesn't. I love you both.
All right, buddy.
I love you. See you later.
For what you do.
All right, Khalil. Take care. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Okay, so this is a little teaser. The next episode, we will discuss that transvestite in Cleveland. So we will do that. That is indeed this life.
She was transgender.
Whatever. We'll transsexual, transgender. We'll sort it all
out. I want to say the right thing so I don't get attacked.
No, I know. That's what I want to sort out is who this actually was and what was the deal and how you felt about it. But this life has been more a little Bob's life this week. So that in the heels of a lot of heavy stuff. And I kind of feel relieved, frankly, because I was feeling pretty bad coming into this. But there's a lot more material. Yeah. A lot more material to cover. So we'll see you next time.
And cocaine, I love them both, yeah.